I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today, our clinical investigator faculty provide some perspectives on new data sets that have been presented over this past year in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We're thrilled to have Dr. Matt Davids and Dr. Jennifer Woyak to comment on these data sets. But today, we're here to talk about CLL. Here's where we're heading today. Of course, we're really going to focus our attention on first-line therapy. There's so much to talk about there. We'll start out talking about some of the key data sets that came out this year for BTK inhibitors, BCL2, of course, venetoclax. And finally, there are lots of new strategies we could talk about, combinations, et cetera. But for sure, we want to talk about the so-called U2 regimen, PI3 kinase inhibitor now, umbralisib with the anti-CD20, and of course, CAR T therapy. But before we get into that, just want to kind of take a breath and sort of take the pulse of the audience as it relates to making decisions in CLL in this past year. We've done a ton of conferences over the past year in CLL. I never get tired of talking about it. It's always different depending on the case. But audience, here's the question I want to ask you. I want to know, over this past year during the pandemic, to what extent did issues related to COVID, social distancing, wanting to avoid lymphopenia, whatever, affect your decision-making for first-line therapy for CLL? I'm going to say a typical patient, mid-70s, minor comorbidities, moderate disease burden, you know, we can say unmutated disease who requires treatment. And Jennifer, it looks like the audience, the most common answer in the audience is they're more likely to use BTK inhibitors. And it was interesting because right up until the pandemic, I saw a lot of momentum for venetoclax and obinutuzumab. And I thought I kind of saw people taking a breath as COVID sort of came into the picture. Of course, at Ohio State, you know, I guess the problem's not maybe quite as bad as it is, for example, in LA right now. I know in Boston it's pretty difficult. But I'm curious, Jennifer, how you're thinking through first-line therapy and to what extent COVID's coming into your discussions.
Yeah, so I think that's such an important topic right now. And it kind of has for me depended mostly on the patient. So, you know, if I have a patient who is really taking precautions seriously, is very strictly isolating, is wearing a mask, I feel like they have very minimal contact outside of, you know, the healthcare system, I would consider choosing either a BTK inhibitor or a BCL2 inhibitor. For those patients where, you know, they may have a little bit more contact with people, or when the cases have been up, I'm choosing BTK inhibitors, you know, for the ease of administration, ability to do more telehealth visits, and also potential benefits of being on a BTK inhibitor with COVID.
So, Matt, curious about your perspective. You know, I was mentioning to both of you that if you look across medical oncology today, and of course, we're doing CME in every part of oncology, I don't think there's a more interesting, compelling decision that oncologists are making today than first-line therapy for CLL. I mean, the difference is not so much in efficacy, but what the patient's going to go through is so dramatic. You have the COVID. It really is a unique situation. Matt, any thoughts on what's going on in Boston right now? I know earlier on last spring, things were very difficult. What I was hearing in the summer sounded like it was getting better. Now I'm starting to hear bad things again.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. The pendulum has sort of been swinging back and forth over the summer. We didn't have any issues getting our patients in to do venetoclax or obinutuzumab, but it has gotten a little tougher now. And, you know, the caseload is higher here in Boston. We can certainly do it if we have a patient who is motivated and wants to do it. But I have had some patients now choosing BTK inhibitors a little bit more based on the convenience factor. We start the drug and they can be monitored even with local labs. They don't need to come into the center here for the dose ramp up with venetoclax. You know, there's also some intriguing sort of theoretical benefits of BTK inhibitors and whether they may blunt some of the inflammatory response in more moderate to severe COVID. There's studies ongoing to look at that prospectively, so I think that'll be interesting to see if it bears out. We really don't know yet.
You know, another issue in terms of COVID, and we can and have, we've done entire webinars just on COVID and CLL. I think, Matt, you were involved with one of those. But just curious now, Jennifer, what you're thinking about in terms of the vaccine for your patients. I've heard people say, you know, maybe they're going to hold back on CD20 or, you know, anything that you're doing differently. What are your thoughts about the vaccine in patients with CLL, Jennifer?
Well, we know that vaccines tend to be less effective in patients with CLL, just no matter what, irregardless of therapy. And certainly potential for any of our therapies, especially the CD20 antibodies, to limit vaccine effectiveness. If I think that we have not known until very recently when our patients are going to be vaccinated, which makes it hard to time therapies or plan therapies around a vaccine. I do have a few patients who are getting rituximab or obinutuzumab or something where I can hold it for a couple of months. A couple of months might not do it, but that's the only therapy that I'm really changing if I have the opportunity to do so. Otherwise, I'm recommending that patients get the vaccine, just knowing that the efficacy may not be as robust.
Matt, any thoughts about the vaccine? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, similar thoughts. I am strongly recommending that all my CLL patients get vaccinated. We don't have any particular safety concerns around the vaccine. I think the question is, as Jennifer raises, is the efficacy. But I do think it will have some effect and benefit. So I think it's good for patients to get it. We have this opportunity in CLL, especially in the watch and wait setting, to kind of decide when we want to initiate therapy. And there's a number of patients I've been following recently where I am kind of dragging my feet a little bit in starting treatment because I want to get them vaccinated for COVID before I start treatment. And as long as it's safe to do that from the CLL perspective, I think that is advisable.
So we have a interesting thought from the chat room. What about IVIG and the vaccine? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I think this is a situation where we really don't know the answer. So I mean, there's concerns that you may have increased side effects, decreased efficacy if you have COVID antibodies in the IVIG. I think it's reasonable to maybe hold IVIG for a few weeks before you give the vaccine. I don't think there's any reason to hold it longer than, 2 weeks to a month, though.
Interesting. So I guess I should be saying vaccines. Let's get into the nitty-gritty here. Audience, this typical patient that we talked about, unmutated IGVH, no del17p 253, 70-year-old patient. What's that patient most likely to get treated with in your clinic right now, this week? Interestingly, so Jennifer, I'm curious what your thoughts are. Looks like the audience, most common answer in the audience, actually is like three or four answers, so it's definitely not a consensus. But acalabrutinib, a little bit more than ibrutinib, and venetoclax coming in a little bit third, at least in terms of our audience. How do you think through this situation, Jennifer? And from your point of view, is the efficacy, other than issues about duration of therapy, toxicity, is your view that the basic efficacy of a venetoclax approach with the BTK, from your point of view, about the same?
I think for this type of patient with intermediate risk CLL, all evidence would suggest that efficacy is going to be about the same among all these regimens. And I think that it really comes down in my mind to, patient-related factors, safety considerations, and how those relate to the individual patients.
So what's your most likely, what's the usual thing that people are walking out of your clinic with, or is it 50-50, or what are they usually getting?
So I would say I tend to discuss BTK inhibitors in general, and then with a patient this age with some comorbidities, maybe leaning a little more towards acalabrutinib versus venetoclax, obin. I think many of my patients choose a BTK inhibitor, just given the ease of starting and not having to come in for infusions.
So it's interesting. There is a small fraction of the audience that says acalabrutinib slash anti-CD20 antibody, probably obinutuzumab. Matt, how do you usually approach this decision? And I've heard people say that, like in young patients with a lot of tumor burden, they might think about giving a CD20 and obinutuzumab with acalabrutinib. How do you think that went through? And what's your usual approach to first-line therapy, Matt?
So just starting with that first point, I mean, I think that we've seen a couple of randomized studies, including one that Jennifer led in the frontline setting, showing no benefit to adding rituximab to ibrutinib. And so the question of obinutuzumab with acalabrutinib is a very different one because we've seen now randomized data from the ELEVATE-TN study suggesting that actually perhaps there may be a small PFS benefit to adding obinutuzumab to acalabrutinib. Now, that was a post-hoc analysis in the study. It wasn't powered really to look at it. So it's provocative. I think we'll need to see the results in longer-term follow-up to understand that better. It is something that I mentioned to patients about the potential for a PFS benefit, and if I have a patient who really wants to truly maximize PFS, they may choose that. So far, I don't think I've had anyone choose to add the obinutuzumab because there's something just very easy about starting the acalabrutinib. We know it's going to be very effective, and there's no clear benefit to adding the CD20. I would say, I have a similar discussion as Jennifer has, the pros and cons of BTK inhibitor versus venetoclax obinutuzumab. Probably a little more of my patients are choosing venetoclax obinutuzumab. Maybe it's a little bit of how I'm pitching it to them, but I think a lot of my patients really do like the idea of the time-limited therapy.
And it's interesting, Jennifer, this concept of time-limited therapy, which is a pretty new concept of CLL. I'm actually hearing oncologists bring this up with other therapies outside of CLL. It's like kind of made people think a little bit about the value of shorter-term therapy. And there are other situations in oncology similar to that. Well, let's talk a little bit about the data that came out over this past year. We saw some data related to BTK inhibitors, particularly related to follow-up. And Matt presented these data, and maybe one thing before we get started, Matt, is we're starting to hear now about new agents. Everybody's wondering what comes after BTK and venetoclax, and we maybe you can talk a little bit about irreversible, reversible BTK inhibitors, and some of these new agents, LOXO-305, in terms of efficacy in patients who've already had double in both approaches, and whether you see maybe these things heading into first line therapy with time, Matt.
Yeah, so as you see here on the slide, there's three irreversible inhibitors. These are covalent BTK inhibitors, so they bind to BTK and they stay locked in there. And you can see the kinome profile of ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib, so there's different specificities. Zanubrutinib, we just have the structure there, but it's sort of a little bit in between the two, maybe a little closer to acalabrutinib. It's a more selective, irreversible BTK inhibitor. But I think one of the exciting developments over the last couple of years at the bottom there is the reversible BTK inhibitors. These are non-covalent inhibitors and really have opened up these floodgates. ARQ-531 and LOXO-305 both bind in a different way, and the idea is hopefully to be able to overcome the C481S BTK mutation that Jennifer and others have described, which is the most common reason why patients become resistant to ibrutinib and probably acalabrutinib as well. And so we've seen some more mature data on LOXO-305, which in addition to being a very potent BTK inhibitor, is also highly specific. You can see it from the kinome plot there. So from the safety perspective and toxicity profile, it also looks very clean. So I think we're excited about this new generation of drugs, particularly for patients progressing on BTK inhibitors. But as you allude to, I think even in the frontline setting, it'll be interesting to generate some data with these new molecules.
So Jennifer, I'm curious what we know about tolerability issues here. Do you see, the kinds of things that we're seeing with ibrutinib, for example, in terms of cardiac effects with these agents? And maybe you can chat a little bit too about these resistance mutations. Oncologists all over the country are asking me about it. Where do we send the test, et cetera? Maybe provide an update on that as well. But first, what do you know about tolerability of these new agents?
So the reversible BTK inhibitors have been very tolerable. And I think what's very clear with newer agents coming forward is the more specific you get for BTK, the better tolerated the agent will be. And LOXO-305 is extremely well tolerated. Acalabrutinib, extremely well tolerated. Zanubrutinib, too, extremely well tolerated. It's interesting that ARQ-531, it's very a non-selective inhibitor, but also pretty well tolerated and has different side effects than what we've seen with ibrutinib too. So I would say I don't have any concerns about tolerability. As Matt mentioned, we know that many times, like all of these covalent inhibitors have the same binding site on BTK. So mutation of that binding site is naturally going to be a common mechanism of resistance. And I think we've seen in limited series this to be true with acalabrutinib. I think with accumulating data, we'll probably see this with zanubrutinib as well. With the reversible BTK inhibitors, we don't know why patients will become resistant to those. My guess is it will either be something outside of the B-cell receptor pathway, making that pathway not as important for patients for that CLL, or potentially these gatekeeper mutations, which should affect efficacy to all of the BTK inhibitors.
So do you think, of course, this is, research and evolution, Jennifer, but there's a lot of excitement. It makes a lot of sense. You see this in other cancer, lung cancer, looking for resistance mutations to targeted therapy. Is this something that is clinically useful right now?
So it depends. We tend to do it a lot at Ohio State, and we actually have clinical trials where, you know, we'll take somebody who has not clinically progressed on a BTK inhibitor but has a mutation and try to add something to the BTK inhibitor to eliminate the resistance mutation. So I think there's, you know, definitely reasons to do it in a clinical trial setting. Outside of a trial, I do find it to be helpful in a patient who you think might be progressing, but there may be something else going on. And if you see a resistance mutation, I think you can be more comfortable saying, okay, yeah, the rise in white count is probably because of this and not a chronic infection or something.
How about the CLL Center at Dana-Farber, Matt? Are you using these assays?
We are, but in a similar way, more on the sort of research side. You know, we have trials open of the reversible BTK inhibitors, so prioritizing those patients who we discover do have a BTK mutation to go on those trials, for example. But I'd say right now it's not directly impacting practice outside of the trial setting.
So, Matt, in your talk, one of the things you talked about was, of course, the landmark E1912 study comparing ibrutinib to FCR. And during this past year, we actually, as you see in the lower corner there in April, saw the expansion of the indication to ibrutinib to include rituximab and a few other points. Anything you want to say about the longer-term follow-up on this study, Matt, and also, again, this issue of anti-CD20 plus ibrutinib?
Yeah, so first on that latter point, you know, this study was designed before we had the readout from two different randomized trials showing no benefit to adding rituximab in terms of PFS to ibrutinib. So, you know, it made sense at the time when the study was designed, but I sort of extrapolate from the study to imagine what the ibrutinib alone data would look like and probably would look very similar. So I don't usually use rituximab there. You know, I think in terms of the longer follow-up here, you know, they're still seeing the overall survival benefit to using ibrutinib-based therapy frontline over FCR, which I think is important, even or kind of early in the course, seeing an OS benefit is something we need to pay attention to. If you look at the subgroup analyses, particularly around PFS in particular, you see that the PFS curves do still look fairly similar for the mutated IGHV patients. There's no statistically significant difference. So the greatest benefit is in the unmutated IGHV patients. We know what's going to happen in the long term for the mutated IGHV FCR-treated patients. About 60% of them are going to have long-term disease-free survival, sort of functional cure, based on the older MD Anderson data. We don't know yet what's going to happen very long term with ibrutinib. We have 7 or 8 years of data, which look very good. So I think these are both great options for patients. This is still the one scenario, though, for mutated IGHV patients who are young and fit, where I do still consider FCR as a standard.
So yeah, when the data first came out, there were a lot of people saying FCR, and that number seems to have dropped down. But we'll see later what the audience thinks, as we actually have a question about that. So before we go on, Jennifer, Adriana in the chat room wants to know why you choose acalabrutinib over ibrutinib.
So we know that acalabrutinib has lower rates, at least in these cross-trial comparisons, of things like atrial fibrillation, hypertension. It also, you know, at least kind of anecdotally and from experience, tends to have lower rates of the muscle aches and the arthralgias and things like that that are problematic and sometimes do make people stop therapy. Reasons to choose ibrutinib over acala would be the once daily dosing and that it does not interact with proton pump inhibitors. And that can be a really big issue with acalabrutinib. But I would say for, you know, patients who are at risk of cardiac complications and older patients, they do tend to tolerate acalabrutinib a little bit better, in my opinion.
So another person in the chat room, Jennifer, wants to know, are infectious complications with acala the same as ibrutinib?
They probably are. We know that specifically the fungal infections like aspergillus. So aspergillus clearance requires BTK in order to activate like monocytes and then neutrophils to actually clear the infection. So both acala and ibrutinib should have an increased risk of fungal infections. Other infectious complications, I don't know, are that different between the two agents. The older ibrutinib studies and even the newer ones tend to have higher risk patients on them, especially in the relapse setting, just because at the time that those were the patients who were participating in these phase one studies.
So Matt, you know, we saw at the ASCO meeting, the endurance trial in myeloma comparing KRD with carfilzomib to RVD with bortezomib. And a little surprised, the efficacy was the same, but different tolerability issues. Curious what your predictions are. Hopefully maybe we'll see the ELEVATE trial results comparing ibrutinib to acalabrutinib. I think a lot of people are assuming the efficacy is going to be the same, but maybe there will be a difference in tolerability. I kind of was wondering, well, maybe we will see a difference in efficacy. And we'll talk about some data that you put together, kind of trying to make some guesses. But just, do you want to put $5 down right now, Matt, on what you think it's going to show?
It's a tough one, Neil. I mean, I think that my guess is that the efficacy will end up looking similar. It's a non-inferiority study, so I think it's likely to sort of come out in that margin in terms of PFS, which is the primary endpoint. Fortunately, it's taking a long time to reach that endpoint because the patients are doing very well on both drugs, so that's great for the patients. It's been frustrating for us because we want to get the data. You know, I think one of the challenges with ELEVATE-RR is that it's designed around an efficacy endpoint, and so we'll certainly be able to make some safety comparisons, but these are not necessarily powered. They're certainly not powered as the primary endpoint. So, you know, that you may see some underpowering there, and maybe you see some numerical differences, but they're not statistically significant. At the end of the day, you're still wondering, is there truly a difference between these drugs? My guess, based on what Jennifer was saying earlier, I have a sense also that acalabrutinib is going to be a bit better tolerated. And if it's comparably efficacious, that is definitely favorable for acalabrutinib.
Another thing we saw this year, Jennifer, that Matt went over in his talk, is a longer-term follow-up of the RESONATE-2 trial. I always thought this was interesting to do this trial because I think everybody that I was talking to kind of had a pretty strong, you know, if you saw a single arm study that had this benefit, you know, I wonder, you know, about the patients who went in a chlorambucil. But Jennifer, the thing, I don't know, it kind of snuck up on me a little bit, was the incredible power of ibrutinib here. And you see a PFS of 70% at 5 years, and some of that's people coming off for toxicity. Any thoughts about this long-term benefit that you see? And also the fact that, you know, ibrutinib doesn't seem to significantly cause MRD negativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is really kind of an unprecedented treatment in CLL. 70% five-year progression-free survival is just outstanding. And, you know, we see that very few, it's not like the curves are starting to drop precipitously either. You know, we would expect that we're going to see this benefit for a really long period of time. So if MRD is important in CLL, you don't get MRD negativity with BTK inhibitors, how do you reconcile those? And I think these are just very, very different drugs. So we know that BTK inhibitors do not produce undetectable or usually even low minimal residual disease. And even if you look at these patients at 5 years, only 30%, maybe a little bit higher at 5 years, will actually have developed a complete response. And even many fewer of those will actually be MRD negative. But you have a continuous therapy that works despite not attaining minimal residual disease. And I think it just says that with this class of agents, MRD negativity is not important.
Matt, another question came in the chat room for Praveen about fungal infections with BTK, and I think you all published on this, right?
Yeah, so we've presented data on this. Actually, a number of groups have over the years, and clearly there does seem to be some increased risk of fungal infections in BTK inhibitors. It's been best described with ibrutinib, but honestly, I think that's because we have the longest experience with ibrutinib and the most patients treated. So as Jennifer said, I think with other drugs like acalabrutinib, I expect that to come out more over time as well. It can happen in transplant patients, as Praveen was asking, but it can certainly happen outside of the transplant setting, as is more common in CLL.
I see another question about re-cheating with BTK, Jennifer. So you have a patient starts out on BTK, then they go to venetoclax. What about going back to BTK after that?
So we actually published a paper earlier this year in Blood where we were looking at patients who had been on a BTK inhibitor, all ibrutinib, developed resistance to ibrutinib, went on to venetoclax, developed resistance to venetoclax. And really interestingly, in all of these patients, the BTK mutation came back when patients relapsed on venetoclax. So I think that would suggest that no, you can't go back to ibrutinib or acalabrutinib in that setting.
There's also been some interesting data that Anthony Mato and colleagues have recently published in Clinical Cancer Research, actually looking at two different groups. So one, the group that Jen just described, and indeed those patients had a pretty short PFS when they went on a BTK inhibitor for a second time. But there was another group of patients that had previously come off a BTK inhibitor due to intolerance, then went on to venetoclax, and then got a BTK inhibitor again. And that group actually did quite well on the BTK inhibitor. So I think the reason for stopping the BTK inhibitor is critical to understand if they might respond to a second course.
So, Jennifer, one of the papers that Matt talked about was actually your study, and I'm curious if you can try to explain it to us.
Sure. So this was a study of acalabrutinib plus obinutuzumab in two different cohorts of patients. So treatment naive CLL patients and those who were relapsed refractory who had not previously received a BTK inhibitor. This study was started a few years ago, obviously, and based on the hypothesis that acalabrutinib would better combine with a CD20 antibody than ibrutinib because of the increased specificity and lack of ITK inhibition. So in this study, we continued the acalabrutinib continuously, except in patients who developed an MRD negative CR, which they were allowed to stop the drug but did not actually have to. We've seen really outstanding results. It's a small study, but it's a little bit over 3 years, almost 95% of our treatment naive patients are progression free. And at 3.5 years, about 73% of our relapsed refractory patients are progression free. We also saw a lot of people develop low or even undetectable minimal residual disease with this combination.
Interesting. So, of course, we know that we have the phase three Elevate trial that what we were talking about earlier, and you see there that at the top a little bit of a difference when you add in obinutuzumab. But Matt, I want to hear about some of these combinations. I'm thinking one of these days we're going to wake up in the morning, there's going to be a positive trial, and all of a sudden oncologists are going to have to figure out how to deal with this. But this is a phase two study that you talked about in your talk, that this was actually presented at the ASH meeting. I guess you presented it. Can you talk about what was seen there?
Yeah, so this is our phase two investigator-initiated study of acalabrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab. I should mention also that Jennifer presented data from a similar approach of AVO and also AVR, both frontline and relapse at the ASH meeting. So there's accumulating data now with this type of triplet-based approach. And I think also later in the presentation, you might show some data with zanubrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, and ibrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab. So all the different combinations. So our version of this is acala with ven and obin. And you can see here the toxicity profile looks quite favorable. Only about a third of patients with grade three or higher neutropenia. We saw very few significant infections, actually just one grade three infection in 44 patients with a median follow-up of about a year and a half. We only saw one case of atrial fibrillation and just a little bit of laboratory tumor lysis syndrome that actually happened after the obinutuzumab, before the patients even started venetoclax. So it's been a very well-tolerated triplet. And I think I had a slide in the presentation also with the efficacy data where we're seeing very deep responses in terms of undetectable MRD, which allows this to be a time-limited therapy that we hope will have a very durable benefit.
You were mentioning obinutuzumab and TLS. I'm curious, Jennifer, whether you've actually seen that. But the idea of reducing the risk of TLS, either with obinutuzumab and now in this trial, the obinutuzumab plus BTK, you can see on this graphic here on the right that the TLS risk dramatically decreased by the time they actually got venetoclax. Jennifer, in general, what do you think about that strategy? For example, the obinutuzumab debulking. And you also have the issue of in the Murano's trial and the relapse disease, first of all, not only did they use rituximab, but they didn't have this, sort of the same kind of a schedule. I'm curious what your thoughts are about this and what you do in the relapse setting.
Yeah, so I think that in these triplet combinations, this strategy of debulking with the BTK inhibitor and obinutuzumab or rituximab really makes a lot of sense. We've saw as well in our in both AVO and our study of IVO that you could reduce almost all patients out of that high TLS risk category. So it reduces obviously the burden of hospitalization for the patients. In terms of what to do with the Murano data and that regimen where you start the venetoclax first, I do think rituximab is not as good of a debulking agent as obinutuzumab is. So you may get the white count down enough to lower the TLS risk, but I think for most patients, you're not going to actually make the, a 10 centimeter lymph node much smaller in a month's time. It gives patients a chance to progress on the single agent drug too. So I think that the best way to do this is with a BTK inhibitor and with a CD20 antibody.
So Matt, you were talking about the efficacy data here. Maybe you can comment on that. And it's interesting how things change as you follow these patients.
Yeah, so on the left side, you see the IWCLL response. So at cycle 16, which was the end of the sort of this planned 15-month time-limited therapy for the undetectable MRD patients, about 44% had a CR. And that was true if you had TP53 mutation or deletion 17p or not. And then on the right, you see the MRD results, where we had about 84% of the patients having undetectable MRD in the blood, and very similar results in the 17P TP53 group. So I think one of the things that we're very interested in is the efficacy of AVO specifically in these high-risk patients. So we actually amended the study recently to focus in on that group to try to really get some additional data, because I personally think that's where the benefit of these triplet therapies is going to be greatest, is going to be in the high-risk patients. And it may be that lower-risk patients can do just fine on a single agent or maybe a doublet.
One of the things I heard about, Jennifer, I'm the last person to hear about, is this concept of MRD high and low. Can you comment on that, Jennifer?
Yeah, so this has been a kind of newer classification where I think the MRD high is like 1% or higher, and then between that and the 0.01% would be MRD low, and then you have the MRD undetectable. And, you know, as you may expect, those patients that have more residual disease at the end of therapy tend to have quicker progressions than those that are low in terms of their disease remaining, and, you know, still shorter progressions than those that are undetectable at the end of therapy with these time-limited treatments.
So, Matt, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about the work that you discussed that was actually, I think it was presented at the EHA meeting. You know, in the past, we always said, oh, we don't want to do indirect comparison. I remember your colleague in breast cancer, Hal Burstein, putting up a slide comparing the three CDK inhibitors, saying, no, I'm not supposed to do this, but it looks exactly the same. Right. So anyhow, with all the caveats there, maybe you can talk a little bit about this fascinating work.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you know, I think that we're all eagerly awaiting the randomized data, but in the meantime, we're seeing patients every day and we have to make these decisions. So we can either make it anecdotally based on our experience with a handful of patients, or we can at least try to put some statistical rigor to comparing the trials that we have. And that's what we tried to do with this match-adjusted comparison here, you know, where you're really trying to match the baseline characteristics of the patients on the trial to make them as close as possible to try to get at some kind of meaningful comparison. So with all of the caveats and limitations of doing that, we did see differences between acalabrutinib and ibrutinib, as you see here, particularly around the toxicity profiles, with lower rates of atrial fibrillation, in particular with acalabrutinib, less edema and hypertension, even less major hemorrhage. You do see a little bit more in the way of headache, which actually was sort of a nice positive control in our study, because we know that that's more common with acalabrutinib from our experience, and that's what we saw in this analysis. As I said, for ELEVATE-RR, I don't expect there to be major differences, and that's basically what we're seeing here. I mean, most of these bars are crossing one, suggesting no statistically significant difference between the acalabrutinib and the ibrutinib-based regimens. A little bit of an outlier on the lower right. There seemed to be an overall survival benefit favoring acalabrutinib with or without obinutuzumab compared to ibrutinib with or without obinutuzumab. Don't quite know what to make of that. You know, I think it's hard to know, but I think to me this looks pretty similar in terms of efficacy.
Yeah, I thought when we made our $5 bet, you were going to say the acalabrutinib was better because of this little hint that you see here. I'm hoping maybe that'll be the case. Jennifer, we mentioned zanubrutinib, of course, approved now in mantle cell. What do we know about this agent, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability?
Yeah, so it looks to have very good efficacy in CLL based on a number of studies that have been performed. Mostly, follow-up is pretty limited in terms of, you know, long-term efficacy, but short-term efficacy has looked outstanding. One thing that has kind of struck me about zanubrutinib is its ability to have the BTK occupancy in the lymph nodes, which is something that just hasn't really been studied with the other BTK inhibitors, but something that may differentiate it. In terms of safety, it looks very safe. It may have less cardiac side effects than ibrutinib, and that's been shown in the comparison study in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, where there were lower rates of cardiac toxicity with zanubrutinib. Again, all the zanubrutinib studies have fairly short follow-up, so I think it's going to really take a lot more accumulating data to really say how much difference that we'll see there.
So, you know, we talked about the Sequoia study with zanubrutinib, and we'll see where that heads. But Matt, I wonder if you could comment on this slide, which you showed.
So, Anthony made this slide, but it's Jennifer's data primarily. You know, you see that from their experience that there's other events that patients come off of ibrutinib for, which is often infections and other complications that are due to toxicities. And then you see the yellow curve, which is Richter's syndrome, which can occur relatively early for high-risk relapse patients. But I think what's been most intriguing in recent years has been that gray curve of CLL disease progression over time, which we do see particularly in the relapse setting with ibrutinib, particularly in the higher-risk patients. And then on the right in that pie chart there, you can see the breakdown of different resistance mutations, which, you know, the majority of patients have a BTK mutation. Some of them also have PLC gamma 2 mutations. There is a small portion of the pie where no mutation is identified. But this, I think this type of setup really set the stage for the development of the newer reversible BTK inhibitors.
So Jennifer, another thing that's interesting about this is, you know, that the actual discontinuation rate in frontline therapy at 5 years is 41%. Where do you think we are today with managing toxicity from the BTK inhibitors, particularly ibrutinib? Do you think that those old numbers, if we were to look at it right now in terms of sort of the real world, are going down as people sort of learn how to manage these problems and select the patients?
Yeah, I think that that is definitely the case, that we've learned a lot about managing toxicities with BTK inhibitors over time. And actually, Anthony Mato presented an abstract at ASH. It was kind of their large CLL registry, and the rate of discontinuation was lower than what had previously been published a few years ago. The one thing I think that has changed the opposite direction, though, is now that we have acalabrutinib, I think that there are toxicities that people are very quick to switch if a patient experiences. So like if I see a patient who develops AFib on ibrutinib, I just switch them now to acalabrutinib. I don't wait and see if we can manage through it. And, you know, sometimes I will do the same for the arthralgias and things that are really significantly limiting a patient's quality of life.
So it's a second opinion, Matt. Ibrutinib, atrial fibrillation, you go to acala or venetoclax?
So, you know, it depends a little bit, but I'd say generally if they're otherwise tolerating a BTK inhibitor well and their CLL is responding nicely, I will try switching them to acalabrutinib. But, you know, if for some reason they're having a lot of BTK inhibitor type toxicities, or maybe they're not having as great of a response as I'd like, I might switch them to venetoclax. So it depends.
Jennifer, any comment? I hear a lot about arthralgias with BTK inhibitors, mainly ibrutinib. Any comments on the mechanisms involved and the difference in the BTK inhibitors as part of this particular problem? And in your own experience, how much of a problem is it?
I don't know what the mechanism is, but I think we can pretty clearly say that it is not BTK, because the more selective BTK inhibitors tend to have less arthralgias. You know, in terms of management, I find that short courses of steroids sometimes will take it away completely, and you can reinitiate the BTK inhibitor. Sometimes lowering the dose works fairly well, and sometimes switching the BTK inhibitor works very well. Because I've had a few patients where the arthralgias do persist even if you switch to acalabrutinib. I've not tried to zanubrutinib yet, but most patients it will get better.
So we were talking before about LOXO-305. Here's some of the more recent data. You can check it out in the slide set. Kind of nice looking waterfall plot there. But let's start getting into the nitty gritty and making decisions and see where the audience is standing. So audience, you've got a younger patient, 6 years old, IGH mutated disease. So, you know, kind of the classic situation we used to look for as it relates to FCR, no DEL17P or T53. What are you thinking? It looks like about a third of the audience is still saying FCR. And then it looks pretty much split between acala, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, and ibrutinib not too far behind. So this is what we call not a consensus. Matt, how are you thinking through this situation? Are you still, when was the last time you used FCR in CLL, Matt?
It has been a little while, and the age of the patient really factors in for me here. So 60, different from 50, different from 40, occasional 40-year-old we might see. So by the time they get to 60, you know, even if they're fit, I'm leaning more toward venetoclax obinutuzumab now. And that's a pretty recent change. I mean, a year and a half ago before we had venetoclax obinutuzumab, I probably wouldn't have hesitated to recommend FCR for this patient. But, you know, these patients, I think, can benefit from a time-limited novel agent-only regimen with probably less long-term risks in terms of AML and other serious complications we can see with FCR, particularly for older patients who get it. So this is a patient I'd probably go with venetoclax obinutuzumab.
Jennifer, I'm curious about second line therapy. And let's say you have a patient who got FCR in the past. Maybe they progressed some, you know, look kind of fast 3 years later. Audience, what are you thinking about in terms of second line therapy in a patient like that? Jennifer, I imagine there's still FCR patients who show up, 2, 3, 5, 10 years later. Hopefully not 10 years later with relapse. Again, the audience looks very heterogeneous. So acalabrutinib, ibrutinib about the same. Actually, you see more venetoclax for some reason right now, and this almost half the audience says either venetoclax, actually with anti-CD20, quite a few people. Jennifer, how do you think through the situation?
Yeah, so I think this is a scenario where we have long-term data, luckily, with both ibrutinib in this setting from the RESONATE study, as well as venetoclax rituximab in the Murano study. And the median progression-free survival is actually pretty similar between those two, 44 months in the RESONATE study, 52 months in the Murano study. So I do think that either a BTK inhibitor or venetoclax, specifically rituximab, is what's been tested in this setting with 2 years of venetoclax therapy would be really reasonable. In some of these patients who are a little bit younger, I do tend to consider ibrutinib over acalabrutinib only because of the once-a-day dosing, just because I think that it can be difficult for somebody who's not already on a number of other medications to start taking a twice-a-day medication regularly.
If I could I just add one thing? I totally agree with that, but I do want to point out that with that median PFS that we just saw for the first time at ASH for Murano, 53.6 months, compared to the 44 months with ibrutinib, obviously comparing across studies, but the key difference, remember, with Murano is that's 2 years of therapy, whereas with the ibrutinib, that's a continuous therapy given that whole time, and then you see that median progression-free survival. And so we have this data that's evolving on retreatment with venetoclax with Murano, which is appealing. It's very early, but to me, that's an intriguing aspect of the Murano approach.
So Jennifer, I can't resist this case. This will be a 30-second of you're going down in the elevator from the 12th to the first floor. Somebody's next to you and saying, "Hey, I got this patient, 60 years old, T53 CLL, first line ibrutinib, second line R venetoclax, progression, and then gets CAR T. I think it says MRD positive now." A CLL clonally related Richter's transformation. Any thoughts about post-CAR T Richter's transformation? I guess you don't see that every day, but what do you think, Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. Richter's is one of the, obviously common mechanisms by which people relapse after CAR T. And in this scenario with TP53 mutated CLL, I would say the ultimate goal with this patient would be a stem cell transplant. If you can get them there with, R-CHOP, R-EPOC, Matt has led a phase 2 study, which has looked at venetoclax plus R-EPOC, which has looked really effective in these patients too. But I think probably a chemoimmunotherapy approach given their age and trying to get them to a transplant.
Matt, any general comments about Richter's transformation? Anything exciting? We heard some stuff about immunotherapy. Anything encouraging there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm encouraged that people are focusing more on Richter's now, and there's more of an interest in studying novel approaches. Jen mentioned the chemosensitization approach that we're looking at with venetoclax and chemo. There are some intriguing data with checkpoint blockade. There were some initial reports with responses, although it seems like with larger numbers of patients, checkpoint alone is not going to be enough. There's some intriguing data out of MD Anderson combining nivolumab with ibrutinib for Richter's patients, and maybe the ibrutinib is able to enhance the activity of the checkpoint blockade.
So in Jennifer's presentation, she goes through a whole bunch of trials. Well, we're just going to touch on a couple of them related to venetoclax, but check out her talk to see the full Monty, so to speak. And Jennifer, one of the things you talked about was that we saw the publication this year of follow-up of the CLL 14 study. Any comments on that? Again, amazing progression-free survival to me.
Yeah, I think with the follow-up we have, PFS with venetoclax obin 1 year of therapy looks pretty similar to BTK inhibitors.
So, and then we were talking about the Murano study and the controversy about the way the choice of CD20 and the way it's given, but still outstanding results. Again, check out Jennifer's talk looking at the Captivate study, looking at a combination approach and also involving the use of MRD. Can you talk about this paper, Jennifer, the phase 2 study, kind of similar to what we were talking about before, sort of a triplet approach, and what you've learned so far?
Yeah, so this is a phase two study of ibrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab. This is a study actually that has the longest follow-up of any of the doublet or triplet regimens, including a BTK and BCL2 inhibitor. In this study, we started out leading in with obinutuzumab for a cycle, then adding in the ibrutinib for a cycle, and then starting to ramp up the venetoclax. And as we mentioned before, many patients who started out as high risk for tumor lysis syndrome then became low risk. What we've seen in every one of these doublet and triplet studies is very high rates of undetectable MRD. So this study included treatment naive and relapsed refractory patients, 25 in each group. Two-thirds of the treatment naive, half of the relapsed refractory patients did become MRD undetectable in the blood as well as the bone marrow. And so this is 3-year follow-up, 1 year of treatment, 2 years off treatment. In the treatment naive cohort, one patient died of infection. No other patient has progressed. In the relapsed refractory cohort, now there have been two patients progressing, 2 and a little bit over 3 years after receiving therapy. So it's looking very, all of these doublets and triplets look very, very promising in terms of efficacy.
So the question is, audience, you got a patient newly diagnosed CLL, and you decide you're going to give venetoclax obinutuzumab, and a year later you get an MRD, and the MRD is detectable and actually MRD high. Continue treatment or not? And I'm going to guess that the faculty is not going to agree with the majority here. It looks like two-thirds of the people say continue. Matt, continue or not?
Discontinue. That's what the data show so far. We don't have data suggesting that continuing longer is helpful. Perhaps it could be harmful. We saw data from the ASH meeting that looked at MRD clonal dynamics from the CLL14 study, and about half of the patients had actually rising MRD at that completion mark. And so you can imagine that if you're continuing to give venetoclax and they have rising MRD, maybe you're going to degenerate resistance mutations. Maybe you're better off getting that patient on a clinical trial or at least stopping therapy and seeing how they do off treatment.
Jennifer, any comments on that? You have the pure science, but you also have the clinical practice. Is there any role for MRD measurements outside of clinical trial, Jennifer?
So first, I completely agree with Matt. I would discontinue therapy in this setting. I think it's absolutely fine to use MRD in your clinical decision making in terms of making you feel more comfortable about stopping treatment. And I think probably more importantly, or more commonly, helping to counsel a patient post therapy into what they can expect. Are they going to be somebody who's likely to have 3-year remission duration without being on therapy, or are they likely somebody who's going to have disease progression in a year? Certainly, now we have the ability to do very high sensitivity NGS sequencing for MRD or the kind of traditional standard flow-based methods, which are both good and both provide good information.
Any preference for either method or any assay in particular, Jennifer?
So, I think most of the data right now still is using flow-based MRD, so 10 to the minus 4 to make decisions. And I think it's still a little bit unclear what to do with the knowledge of a 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6 detectable disease, whether how much that plays into progression-free survival. But I think the NGS sequencing method is great. The only difficulty is you need to have that pre-sample or a sample with disease in order to measure MRD later on.
Audience, I want to know in general what you'd be thinking about a 60-year-old patient with del17p CLL. What's your usual first-line therapy audience in this high-risk situation? Looks like the audience again, almost every time we ask her for this is why it's so interesting. You don't see a consensus. There are like four different answers, almost equal. Ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, obinutuzumab, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, almost equal. So, Matt, you want to break the tie and say what you do?
Yeah, so I think those are all reasonable options. Here, in this scenario, unlike with FCR, I consider 60 to be still on the younger side. So I feel like this is a patient who would probably tolerate ibrutinib nicely. I think we have the longest term data for ibrutinib in 17p from the NHLBI study that showed about a 60% PFS at 6 years with ibrutinib. So I would actually still lean toward ibrutinib monotherapy for this patient.
So, Jennifer, any thoughts about that? Any reason to think that acala or any other BTK inhibitor wouldn't? It would be more or less effective than ibrutinib, but we just have the data with ibrutinib.
Yeah, I don't think that we really have any reason to think that acalabrutinib would be less effective based upon all the other acalabrutinib data. But again, that the comparison study is actually in high-risk CLL patients, so there will be a lot of patients on there with 17p deletion.
Another related question, Matt, is whether or not high-risk like 17p justifies early treatment, you know, before the conventional approach. I know there's a trial right now looking at treating these patients where in the past we observed them. What do you think about that idea, Matt? How do you think it's going to play out?
So no role in early treatment outside of a clinical trial. It's the SWOG group is looking at an early intervention strategy, venetoclax-based strategy. We already have some data that have been presented from the German CLL study group, the CLL-12 study, early intervention with ibrutinib in higher intermediate risk patients. And although there's an EFS, event-free survival benefit, as you'd expect, there's no overall survival benefit. And they did see some significant cardiovascular toxicities, as you'd expect, in the ibrutinib group there. So even in 17P patients, I wait until they meet IWCL criteria before treating.
So, Jennifer, this case from the chat room at the Padmaja, the 71-year-old man with del 17p is a patient with known atrial fibrillation on anticoagulation. Any thoughts?
Yes, I do prefer BTK inhibitors in the 17p deleted patients or TP53 mutated patients. The data in those patients looks better with the BTK inhibitors thus far. I would treat with acalabrutinib even in the presence of anticoagulation. Only warfarin is a contraindication to either ibrutinib or acalabrutinib. And so I think, I mean, you could even consider ibrutinib in this patient too, but I think acalabrutinib would be a very reasonable option.
So I want to finish out with a couple of new approaches, ones that I think from what I'm hearing may become very relevant to docs in practice, beginning with the so-called U2 regimen, Matt, umbralisib, a new PI3 kinase inhibitor, and ublituximab, a new anti-CD20. We'll talk a little bit about CAR-T. But what about U2, so to speak, Matt? Can you talk a little bit about sort of what umbralisib is and how it differs from the other PI3 kinase inhibitors that are available?
So umbralisib is a delta isoform specific PI3 kinase inhibitor, as is idelalisib, which has previously been approved now for several years. It's a little more narrow than duvelisib, which is a delta gamma inhibitor. And so far what we've seen with umbralisib has been quite a favorable safety profile, you know, as we compare across studies to the other PI3 kinase inhibitors. I think you see that best in the Unity CLL study in the treatment naive patients, because we know in that population it's been prohibitively toxic to give idelalisib or duvelisib in many cases, whereas here they were able to feasibly give umbralisib. And although they do see some of the immune-mediated side effects like transaminitis and low rates of colitis, it's feasible and you know it's an active regimen. So I think it will be interesting. This is a registrational study, and this will likely become an option to consider for CLL patients very soon.
So what about glucose abnormalities, Matt? You know, capanlisib, which I know is not approved in CLL, of course, that's a huge problem. Do you see that with umbralisib? And which, you know, what is it that causes, you know, the autoimmune problems versus, you know, the hyperglycemia problems in the simplest form?
So I think that has to do with the spectrum of kinase inhibition in terms of the different isoforms. Copanlisib is more of a pan inhibitor, including PI3 kinase alpha. And so we think that that hyperglycemia and also some hypertension is more related to alpha inhibition. So you don't see that typically with umbralisib, which is a delta-specific inhibitor.
So Matt, any predictions? Has this come into a practice this year, do you think?
I think it's likely that U2 will come into practice at some point in 21 and will become an option for our patients, yeah.
Jennifer, can you imagine a situation, if you could, where you, I'm not, because it depends on the, I guess, indication, where you would use it first line?
Yeah, I think that I won't use it often, for sure. The efficacy data with U2 does not look as good as either BTK inhibitors or BCL2 inhibitors. There are definitely patients here or there that, you know, for one reason or another, maybe don't seem like great candidates for a BTK inhibitor, maybe somebody with, like, decompensated heart failure, where you're afraid to give fluids with the venetoclax, don't seem like a good BTK inhibitor candidate. Somebody like that might be very reasonable to use this type of regimen in.
So the last topic, and is something we have spent hours talking about at time, is CAR-T. Where are we today, and what about this TRANSCEND-CLL4 study, Matt, with Lisa Cell? And again, you think this is going to get approved?
Yeah, so you know the data from LisaCell have been presented a couple times over the last year or so, and it does look to be active, about 40-45% of patients achieving complete remissions. And these are often patients who have been post-BTK inhibitor and post-venetoclax in some cases. So you know it's still the minority of patients who are achieving these deep and durable responses. And I think we need to find ways to improve those CR rates. And I think at the ASH meeting, in addition to this monotherapy study, we saw a combination of ibrutinib with LisaCell that also looked very good and maybe a little bit higher CR rate, 60-65%. So I think they may be onto something there. So I think this is likely to get an approval in CLL eventually, and it'll be a good option for our patients.
So any good anecdotes about patients who responded, or maybe you had problems? Jennifer, have you any patients in your practice?
I don't know that I have any great anecdotes from my practice, but certainly, I mean, this can be potentially curative regimen, at least like a long-term remission inducing regimen in very high risk, very heavily pretreated patients.
How do patients do with CAR T patients with CLL, Matt, in terms of tolerating? I assume they have the usual cytokine release and sometimes neurologic problems, kind of similar to what you see with other CD19.
Yeah, I mean, similar types of toxicities, although the rates of these immune toxicities like CRS are a bit lower in the CLL patients, which I think also is related to the maybe impaired immune system in CLL patients, which may also be tied into the lower efficacy that we're seeing. So it's all kind of tied together.